Welcome to I Am, I Have, How It Helps, brought to you by Happerful Magazine and Counselling Directory. On this episode, we hear from psychotherapist and globally acclaimed author, Owen O'Kane. Owen so generously shares much of his expertise around managing change, post-pandemic anxiety, health anxiety, as well as his thoughts on how to become your own therapist, also the name of his new and very brilliant book. I hope you enjoy this episode of I Am, I Have. And if you'd like more mental health and wellbeing content, check out Happerful's YouTube channel and visit happerful.com. Today, I have the great pleasure of speaking to psychotherapist and globally acclaimed author of the Sunday Times bestseller, 10 to Zen, 10 Times Happier, and now his new book, How to Be Your Own Therapist, Owen O'Kane. Welcome, Owen.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this chat. I'd love it if you could talk a bit about yourself and tell our listeners what you think they should know about you.
So as you mentioned, I'm a psychotherapist by profession, but my career was split in two. So the first half of my career was in health, mostly working with people who were terminally ill. And then about halfway through my career, in that line of work, I realised I didn't feel skilled enough to be managing the psychological distress of patients. So I retrained as a psychotherapist. And the second half of my career has been in psychotherapy. And my last job in the NHS was a clinical lead for mental health. That was my last position. And then I wrote the book about 3 years ago. And unexpectedly, you know, it was my first book. That book did incredibly well. And it just took my life and my career off in many, many different directions, really. And I guess, really, it's still doing my job, which is about really promoting mental wellness and helping people make sense of their lives, actually, and getting the best from their life. But I guess, really, it's doing it on a different platform, using the books, the talks. So My work these days, I've got a private practice in London that I do, that I love the clinical work. It's still the heart and soul of what I do. So I still have a private practice. I write the books. I do a lot of talks and I do some random stuff as well. I'm a script advisor for EastEnders and some of their mental health storylines. You know, it's really bizarre, actually, how our life can unfold, but it takes me off in different directions. I've just done a TEDx talk, if anyone's interested in having a look at that. So if you go to TEDx on YouTube and Google Owen O'Kane, you'll find the TED talk, which was nerve-wracking, but one of the best things I've done, because I told my own story and why I do my job. So that's a bit about me professionally. I grew up in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, during a period called the Troubles, and that was kind of a big influencer, really, of my work and why I do what I do, because it was a really anxious place to grow up. And it was only when I left and moved to London that I realised the impact, you know, of all the trauma and what it was like to grow up there. What else can I tell you about me? I play piano, which many people don't know, but I play piano. Yeah, and I've got a little dog called Will, obsessed by my dog.
Oh, well, thank you for that. And thank you for sharing a bit about yourself, because that's something that you also do in How to Be Your Own Therapist. And you talk about how you think it's important that you share what brought you to become a therapist and having therapy yourself. And this is a really wonderful book. And you make it clear it's not instead of therapy if people need therapy. But actually, what I love about everything you write is it's about giving us the power and the tools to help ourselves. So can you share a bit about why you decided to write this particular book?
I really deliberated in my head about what the next book was going to be. I had a couple of ideas about what it was going to be. And I really was struggling with the fact that therapy is still a huge stigma in many places, the UK and Ireland and parts of Europe. It's still really stigmatized. America, it's, you know, it's much more accessible. But I believe wholeheartedly in the power of good therapy. But I also know that there are a lot of people really struggling and waiting for therapy. Now, The Guardian did a piece last year and they estimated that approximately about 8 million people, they think, are waiting for some sort of intervention. Now, that's not my statistics, it's the Guardian's, but they did that in line with NHS providers. And I think it's probably accurate enough that there are a lot of people out there waiting for treatment. And I'm really uncomfortable with that. And having run an NHS mental health team and knowing the demands that there are there, I get how difficult it is. So it's not a criticism of the NHS, because they are doing their best. But I know there's a lot of people struggling. And I also know that a lot of people can't afford therapy. So I really sat and thought about this. And I thought, there are all of these people out there who would really benefit this incredible thing. Why don't I write a book? And I, you know, it's not a replacement of one-to-one therapy. But my argument is, if it gets someone started, or it helps them make sense of who they are and get them on the road to recovery, then I've done my job. Because I guess really what I've learned from this work is very often that one word or a line or a suggestion can sometimes make an incredible difference to someone's lives. We often think it's going to be big and it has to be really complicated, and very often it doesn't. You know, for example, in my line of work, I see people talking to themselves in a really cruel, harsh way regularly. And I think even that one thing that I reinforce a lot in the book, if you can help someone stop doing that, then their life transforms incredibly. So I guess really unapologetically, I decided to write the book in a very pragmatic, easy to use way. The first half of the book is like a crash course in therapy. Second half is how you would integrate that into 10 minutes of your life every day. And I've done that deliberately because I know people are busy, but they will make 10 minutes work. So it's kind of almost like therapying your way through the day. And I have a section called Ready, Steady, Reset, which is just 3 points in your day in which you basically check in with where you're at and make the adjustments. You know, I do it every day in my own life. So I think, well, this is about really trying to, you know, deliver what I practice, but also, you know, try to implement it in ways that people can use and pick up in their own life. So in a nutshell, the motivation was driven by need. And I think, and I know, look, I'm under no illusions that some people, I had a message from someone on Instagram yesterday, a therapist, saying, how on earth can someone be their own therapist? So I know I'm going to get criticism from some people who think, well, you know, can you be your own therapist? My answer to that would be you can, because, you know, my goal in therapy when I meet someone is that they don't need me by the end of treatment. I want to empower someone to find their own kind of inner wisdom, that they become their own therapist. So unapologetically, I think everyone has that therapist within them. We all have the chaotic, dysfunctional side to who we are, but we also have inner wisdom and intuition and insight. Mm-hmm. So I guess really as a therapist, what you're trying to do is you're trying to move someone away from the dysfunction and the chaos and the unhelpful stuff and move them across to this other stuff that they've already got. And I think therapists, we keep it like a secret. And I think, why would we do that? It's not a secret. So that's why I've done the book, really. And I really hope that it lands, because I think anyone could pick up this book and benefit from it.
I believe so too. And I think, you know, the proof is in the reading. It's also about doing the work on ourselves. So firstly, you don't count out therapy if it's something that you need. You absolutely make it clear that people shouldn't be undertaking this work if they're feeling overwhelmed or suicidal. You signpost all of the different charities that people can go to. So I think if anyone's listening to this and thinking, oh, I'm concerned about that, I'd like to assuage your worries, because it comes with those caveats. But it is about that work that we do on ourselves on a daily basis. And actually, if you were having therapy, you might be doing in between sessions.
Of course you would. And that's a big misunderstanding. People think therapy is about just going along and having a chat. And for me, that isn't therapy. Effective therapy, of course, talking's part of it, but it's about actions. It's about doing. It's about the decisions you make. It's the people you surround yourself with. It's the decisions that you're making in your life. So therapy is an overhaul of your life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's getting to know yourself and understand how you think, how you deal with your emotions, how you behave. But it's not a lazy, passive exercise where you, the therapist, is going to make you better, because they are not. No therapist is going to change you. And I say that unapologetically as a therapist. However, many good therapists have the tools and the techniques that will kind of move you in the right direction and help, you know, help get you there, but you do the work. And I think that's kind of what this book is about. You know, this is a book about action and doing. And it's a bit like having a personal trainer. You know, there's no good having a fitness plan if you're not going to implement it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you do make it very easy in 10 minutes a day for us to really think about where we're going.
You know, this is not in any way, shape or form a direct replacement for therapy, but it is going to help. And my argument is, you know, and I don't care how strong the pushback is, something is better than nothing. And what I'm not comfortable with is knowing that there are millions of people out there with nothing. I think the other thing that's probably really important to say is that we hide the word therapy so often. When I did this book, we discovered it hasn't really been done yet. No one's really done how to be your own therapist. There's been lots of tips and techniques and stuff. But it's almost like we apologize for the word therapy, like it's a dirty word. And in the book I talk about, I've had clients ask me not to put therapy in the invoice or take therapist off my sign on the door. You know, I've had all of that stuff. And I think, why do we... You know, why would we do that? So part of the deliberately having the word therapist in the title is actually, no, we're not going to hide this away like it's a dirty secret.
Well, congratulations. I think it's a great book and I'm very lucky to get an early copy. And today we're going to pick up on some of the subjects that you talk about towards the end of the book, because we know from the searches that we see both on Happiful and the Counselling Directory that there are a couple of things that are coming through really strongly for people at the moment. And one of them is change. And the second one is post-pandemic anxiety. You know, we've had a lot of change. Let's start there. It's really difficult sometimes to negotiate change, but change is inevitable in our lives. So why do we find change so hard, in your professional opinion?
In psychology, we often talk a lot about, we talk about anxiety and depression and trauma, and there are all of the other disorders that we talk about. But something we probably don't talk about enough is adjustment disorders, which are very often linked to changes in life. And of course, adjustment disorders will present as anxiety, changes in mood, or people developing habits that are maybe a bit more obsessional or habitual. So it can play out in many, many different ways for people. And I think as human beings, many of us are hardwired for predictability and certainty. Now, if you look at a definition of anxiety, it's an intolerance of uncertainty. So basically, we tend not to, as human beings, tolerate uncertainty very well. We like to sort of know a plan. We like to know what's going to happen. We like order. We like predictability. Now, during the pandemic, I talked about post-pandemic stress disorder. It's not an official diagnosis. It's not PTSD. But during the pandemic, I talked about my concern that when the pandemic ended, that we would see a lot of people struggling with change and adjustment. And that's exactly what I talked about with post-pandemic stress disorder, because you can't lock people away for 2 years, take them away from the routines, expose them to horrific headlines every day, and then pile a whole, you know, multitude of uncertainty on top. If you do that with a population group, what you're going to find is a population group who are really struggling with change and uncertainty. And that's what I talked about with post-pandemic stress disorder, that we're going to see a residual impact. And I think what you just described earlier is exactly what I predicted might happen. People are anxious, they're really struggling to adjust. I think some people are frightened. I said to a friend recently, I'm watching people at the minute and it's almost like a state of disbelief. It feels like people are going around chaotically at the minute, busy, shopping, getting holidays booked. It feels like there's a frenetic, frenzied nature to how we are at the minute. And equally, what I know from clinical practice is a lot of people are worried. They're anxious, they're struggling with the instability. And I guess really how we manage that comes back to what I talked about earlier about how we tolerate uncertainty and how we deal with unpredictability, because very often we want life to go a particular way and we have a notion about how life should be. However, life often delivers the complete opposite of what we want or what we think it should be. And for me, psychological wellness is about how we navigate that middle ground. And that's about psychological flexibility, because the more tolerant you can become and the more you can go with life as it is, not how you think it should be, then I think for me, that's one of the kind of cornerstones for good psychological health. The more we fight life and work against it, the more we struggle.
That's so interesting. And I watched a video that you'd done during the pandemic. I think it was perhaps the second or third lockdown that we went through. And you said, you know, look at what we've coped with so far. Yeah. And it's very interesting, because I can recall very clearly, I live with OCD. I can remember when we were talking about the lockdown and I was terrified about, you know, I'd been in London, I'd been at an event. I was terrified that I'd pass things on to people. And for me, in a way, the minute we locked everything down, there was a sense of safety. But then what happened was we had a, you know, every single day there were new things coming out. And we had different prompts like washing your hands to happy birthday, which at the time I thought was quite problematic for anybody who has OCD or kind of gets into rituals. For me personally, I was thinking about people in the future having those kind of rituals. But actually, after a year, it almost became normal. The behaviours that we got into, mask wearing, washing our hands, keeping a distance, that now we're out the other side. I feel like some people are ready to go back to life before, if that's even feasible. Whereas some people are questioning, how can we go back to life before? How do we know it's not coming back?
Absolutely. And I think there's another part to that. I mean, you've described that brilliantly, but I think the part in the middle is that many people haven't processed or dealt with what's happened. I think that's the key thing for me, because of course people are going to be more anxious. I'm seeing that every day of the week. Of course people are going to have fluctuations in their mood. That's a very normal adjustment after a period of trauma. And I do think the last couple of years have been traumatic for most people to a lesser or greater degree, dependent on context. But if we then just go on as normal, then of course at some point all of that being away, being isolated, being disconnected, not having a normal routine, being fearful a lot of the time, of course that's eventually going to catch up. So my argument is about, and part of the motivation for the book is, you kind of got to deal with what's happened. Therapy, we talk about processing, and processing basically means that you deal and you face up to what's going on so that you don't become stuck. It's almost like untangling knots. And that's what I'm encouraging people to do, is not to, you know, because you described very honestly there about OCD, and as you'll know, with OCD or any of the anxiety disorders, a lot of the drive goes into trying to push it down, keep safe, avoid, you know, all of these things that become safety behaviors, when actually one of the most powerful ways of actually managing any of these difficulties that we talk about is about facing up to them and realizing that you can lean into them and that you survive and nothing terrible happens. And I guess really that's kind of where I think people are struggling at the minute. How do I know that this isn't going to happen again?
Absolutely. How do we start to process that? How do we start to process what we have collectively been through? Because a very small example of this is the supermarket yesterday. So I would say that 3/4 of the people in the supermarket weren't wearing masks. There are a couple of people who were wearing masks and were evidently quite annoyed with the people who weren't wearing masks. And in that moment, I just thought, I must talk to Owen about this, because it feels like there is a resentment because of the differing experiences of pandemic life and post-pandemic life.
I mean, it's a brilliant example because it just kind of descriptively shows where we're at, really. Some people have just decided to put it away and think it's done, it's over, I want to get on with my life. Some people have had enough of mask wearing. Some people don't see the threat anymore and they think, I just want to get on with my life regardless. Other people are terrified of COVID or becoming unwell or contamination. So what you see is a broad spectrum of population, because we all, you know, and it's a good analogy for life really, because we all respond to life in different ways. Not everyone's going to respond in the same way. And I think what you're describing there is people are playing out their responses in different ways, but it doesn't mean, for example, if you see someone in a supermarket who's getting on with it and not wearing a mask, it doesn't mean that they're not struggling or that they don't have a different set of concerns and worries. Because, you know, as you well know, anxiety will play out in different ways for different people. So for you, it might be OCD. For me, it might be more generalized worry. For somebody else, it might be health anxiety. For somebody else, it might be a social anxiety. So the human mind's complicated. And I think as human beings, depending on our makeup, our background, our social circumstances, there's a whole host of factors that kind of almost give anxiety an opportunity to find a way in. And often what it will do, for example, OCD is a brilliant example. Anyone I know who's got OCD, they're normally the nicest, caring, compassionate, you know, responsible people on the planet. They care about what happens and they care about harm and hurt or any things going wrong. So people with OCD are normally the most responsible, compassionate people around, but they worry that they're not, or they worry that something bad will happen, or they're going to be responsible for something bad happening. So actually what it is, it's just an inflated sense of responsibility a lot of the time. And people often don't see that, though. There's nothing wrong with any, you know, and this is an argument I have all of the time. You know, these things that we struggle with as human beings, it doesn't mean that there is anything wrong with us or anything wrong with you or anything wrong with any of your listeners. It just means that humanity has found a weak point. And what it's done is it just kind of almost slides in and think, okay, Lucy, oh, I know she's kind of quite responsible. Here's an area. So this is where anxiety will play out.
One of the things that's great about the work you do is it's looking at that and it's seeing it in a way that's accessible and not definitive.
Absolutely.
So that's something I love about your writing, as you say, we don't have to be defined by it or carry it on.
And you're not, because it's just, it's an aspect of who you are, and it's just an aspect of the way you worry. That's all it is. Now, the difficulty is, of course, when it becomes exaggerated or when it becomes all consuming, or someone does become identified by it, or they believe they are their OCD or their anxiety or their depression, then it almost becomes an identity. What I would say is, no, it's not your identity. It's just a program that your mind plays out. And obviously these programs that the mind plays out can be quite frightening, and they produce all sorts of patterns and catastrophes that go with it. And of course we engage with it and we start to think and provide more information, and then basically it becomes overwhelm. And what I try to do in my work a lot is just to help people see, look, there are some worries in life that are real. We all know that. There are some anxieties that are real. But we also know from the neuroscience that 90% of what you worry about will never come to anything.
Oh, that's a statistic, isn't it? 90%.
90% of our worries generally don't tend to come to anything. So, you know, we spend a lot of time unnecessarily worrying. And I think, look, if I look at my own life, if I look at some of the things I've worried about over the last 5 years, you know, sometimes there might be, you know, if my dog's ill or I'm worried about a family member, that's a warranted worry. But if I then start to create worries and I know that my mind's just beginning to create a story and it's catastrophizing and it's becoming bigger and bigger and suddenly it feels like overwhelm, it's just a story. And it's the ability to be able to spot when your mind has gotten into that spiral. You can say, oh, I recognize this pattern. It's just gone off and it's just telling a story and it's doing what it normally does. And it's learning the ability, rather than to identify and start engaging with it, to say, okay, I know what's happening. I'm catastrophizing, or I'm predicting.
That makes a lot of sense and it's very useful. And you actually just touched upon another term that we're seeing a lot of searches for, which is health anxiety. Because we have been faced with a collective call on our health. You know, we have been told, stay away, stay safe. It's not safe to be around other people. You know, there was the messaging that was very much drummed into us, and to reverse out of that is quite difficult. Can you share anything about health anxiety and post-pandemic life?
It's a great question. So health anxiety has been around for a long time. And, you know, lots of people suffer with health anxiety, you know, before the pandemic existed. And it basically becomes an inflated sense of worry around ill health. And often when you dig deeper around that, though, the fear becomes about how would I cope if I got ill? What would happen to me? How would my family cope? What would I do? So normally you get other themes around health anxiety, around coping. Again, responsibility. What if I'm not able to provide for my loved ones or care for them? So it's never just about health anxiety in itself. There's normally underlying factors that contribute to health anxiety. You know, a bit like what I said earlier, you know, if somebody is prone to being responsible or dutiful or really wants to make sure that they're the breadwinner or that they can cope at all times, and that's how they're driven, if that's how their narrative's driven, then of course, health will become in the area of vulnerability. And of course, a pandemic then might aggravate that significantly for someone. Now, I know it's really difficult because the pandemic was telling us regularly, so it was being reinforced on a daily basis, you should worry about your health, you should adopt safety behaviours, you should stay at home, you should avoid people. So inadvertently, the pandemic reinforced safety behaviours for a good reason at the time. But the interesting thing is, as we begin to emerge out of the pandemic, it's about realizing that the guidance we're given now is it's okay to begin to let go of some of those safety behaviors, because at that particular time, you know, the government and the health officials weren't thinking of health anxiety at the time of guidance. They were thinking of the general population and keeping people safe and keeping numbers down as much as possible. But I think what we've got now is a residual group of people who are now still worried. And I guess what you've got to look at is, I mean, it's like any worry. The reality is the majority of people didn't die as a result of COVID. And that's not to minimize people who did lose their lives or people who have lost. And I want to be really clear about that.
Of course.
But when we're talking about anxiety, we have to think about it globally and we have to look at the bigger picture. The reality is most people survived and didn't get terribly unwell. But of course, what we saw was and we were being told about the people who died and the people who had been hospitalized. That's where our focus was. We weren't focused on the other areas. And of course, the human mind will then go for the catastrophic bad news story. And what I'd be saying is, look, you know, we are not designed to be locked away. We are not designed to be disconnected. We are not designed to live in fear all of the time. And I guess like any other anxiety, with health anxiety, what I'd be saying is it's about gradual steps about, okay, maybe today it is okay to go for a walk, and maybe it's okay to take the mask off for a while today. And I'm not saying that you do everything at once. It's like gradual exposure. You do it at a level that's reasonably comfortable for you, but at the same time you want to feel some degree of discomfort, because when you're challenging anxiety, it shouldn't feel, you know, it's not going to feel fluffy or nice or easy. And I get this all the time when people push back at me on Instagram and I give a tip that they don't like, it's because I'm making them uncomfortable. You know, because we know that difficult things happen, but we also know that there's a time and a place on where our focus should be. And we also know that there are things that are not in our control. And again, learning to manage worry is about, okay, well, this isn't in my control today. So I can make a decision that I'm going to park that worry and I'm not going to carry that with me. So it's really about all of what I'm talking about today is about creating a different relationship with your worry.
And you make it so beautifully accessible, looking at our own mental health and really working on it. You know, you break it down in a way that is so understandable, because when you're in the middle of anxiety or OCD or just, you know, as you talked about, post-pandemic stress, I think it can feel all consuming. So having something which is a simple step that you can do every single day that just starts to change the way you're framing how you're thinking, you know, asking that question, what if I looked at this differently? Or is that true? You know, I think can be really helpful.
It's almost like, you know, this entire book is often about, I describe it like, sometimes in life we've got to almost jump into a helicopter and pull back and look down on what's going on and kind of think, okay, where am I at today? I mean, this is the incredible thing. We get up out of bed every morning and most of us just crash land into our day and we have no clue what we're thinking, what we're feeling. It's kind of almost like getting into a car without never having done a driving lesson. You need to know that these things are really, you need to know what your emotional state is. You need to know where your line of thought is. You need to know what behaviours are working and not working for you, because the moment you know, then you can do something about it. Whereas what I see happening is people, when I meet people sometimes in my practice, they'll come in and they literally can't see the wood for the trees because they're not stopping. So it's kind of a large part of my work is about, okay, look, sometimes it's important just to pull back. And then you look in and you think, oh God, Christ, I can see what I'm doing today. I'm self-deprecating, I'm self-doubting, I'm self-criticising. Look at my behaviours today. They're reckless. You know, I'm not managing stuff today. But it's okay to know all of that stuff, because the moment you know it, then responsibility then comes in and you think, okay, what am I going to do about this? How can I look after myself today? What would make this a bit easier? Look, I have to practice what I preach. If I didn't meditate every day, if I didn't take time out, if I didn't go for a run, if I didn't create gaps in my day to catch a breath, then I wouldn't be able to do my job and do it well. So it's about, this is not like luxury. This is not fluffy psychobabble. You know, this is proper mental well-being maintenance, because your brain is responsible for your entire world, really, in terms of how you see life, how you experience it, how you think, how you perceive emotion, all of that stuff. You know, the human mind is responsible for all of that. So my argument is, why wouldn't you take time out on a regular basis for, you know, for maintenance, for looking after the mind, because it becomes tired, it becomes depleted. Sometimes it doesn't function in the way we need it to. And all of these symptoms that people get, the anxiety, the depression, you know, addictions, anything, you name it, they are all symptoms. They are not definitions of who the person are. They're simply symptoms that play out and they're screaming to the person, okay, listen, I need you to slow down. I need you to adjust. I need you to reevaluate. I need you to rethink. They're screaming to the person to change, essentially. And I think if we can see our mental health symptoms like that, rather than a bad thing or rather than demonizing them or making them scary, it's just about, okay, these are signposts that come up in our life. And when my anxiety comes up, I listen to it and think, okay, well, thank you for coming along. What are you trying to communicate to me? And when you start to work with the emotions and the thoughts and the feelings that way, then, you know, it's really quite empowering, actually, because it's like having an internal guide the whole time, reminding you of stuff, and you work with that, and that changes everything, to be honest. Whereas I think we do the opposite. We run away from it. We think, I don't want this feeling. I hate the anxiety. I don't want to be feeling flat today. I don't want to be feeling fearful. So all the energy goes into pushing away the emotion or the feeling. Whereas I go the opposite way and say, no, don't allow it to be. Don't run from it, because the more you learn you can tolerate it and it doesn't do anything terrible to you, and then you get curious about what it's trying to communicate to you, then you get empowered and your life literally transforms. But what I see most people do is the opposite. They're pushing it away, trying to get rid of it. So we lose something really valuable.
And you encourage people to embrace that discomfort through your book in a very careful, as I said, accessible way. Because you're right, we do try and push it away because it feels hard. And one of the things that you're very clear about is there is a bit of hard work to push through it, but ultimately it's learning and we will be more equipped in the future to deal with it.
I mean, growth never feels easy. It can't. And if it does feel easy, then you're probably not doing it right. that is the bottom line. I mean, it entertains me in therapy sometimes. People think it's going to be lovely and nice and, you know, it's all going to be. And of course, it's not going to be. There's going to be looking at the darker stuff. There's going to be confronting aspects of yourself that are a bit uncomfortable because we all have that darker shadow side. It's part of our humanity. But of course, when we spend all our time trying to fight our shadow side, then we become very distressed human beings. Where actually when we embrace all of it, think, okay, you know, sometimes I get it wrong. Sometimes I screw up. Sometimes I make a mistake. Sometimes I'm not perfect. And we get comfortable with all of that. Then suddenly you're just a much freer human being and a much more alive human being. Whereas, look, if we met 100 people today and I said to you, like, let's talk to 100 people who are struggling, I would put my bank account savings on it that when we would sit down and talk with them, we would discover, apart from the problems that they would tell us, we'd discover underneath a whole host of other things. Perfectionism, rigid rules about how they should be, shame that's never been dealt with. You know, you always find these underlying narratives. And my argument is, you've got to go there. You're a perfectionist, you've got to address your perfectionism. If you're carrying shame, you have to bring your shame out into the light. Don't hide it. If you're carrying rules and beliefs that are rigid and don't work for you, you need to change them because they're going to disable and cripple you longer term. So you've got to learn to work with the darker stuff. And I guess what the book does in a very, very structured, safe way is to say it's okay to go there. As long as you feel you can cope and manage. And if you're not coping and managing, that's equally okay. If you discover that you need more support to do it, then wait for that support or find that support in whatever way you can. But the thing is, don't avoid it and don't run from it.
I feel like I've had a slight reset talking to you as well. I'm going to listen to this, go back and make some notes for myself because it's kind of a universal truth that we all try and hide from those dark bits. You know, we try and push them away, whether that is through compulsions, whether that's through worrying, whether that's through avoidance, whether that's through addiction. We will all try and not face those parts of us. And this book really does start you on that journey.
Here's the thing, and you'll understand this because you've talked very bravely about your own OCD. You know, the obsessions and the compulsions and OCD, as you know, the engagement with the obsession and the compulsions or the rituals or whatever they are what maintains the OCD. So the interesting thing is, shorter term, all of these things that we do might create a bit of ease and make us feel a bit better shorter term. But what we know from all of the evidence, particularly around anxiety, is the more we learn to drop the safety behaviours, then longer term, that's where the recovery comes.
Yes.
So that does mean sometimes it feels uncomfortable. No, today I am going to sit with the urge to do this, but not do it. Today I am going to drop that safety behaviour, even though every part of me is thinking, no, do it. I'm going to stay with it. So it's kind of almost like, I described to someone recently, it's almost like you're trying to stay anchored as much as you can, and you're holding on really, really tight. And you're saying, whatever happens, I'm just going to hold on tight and I'm going to look after myself and I'm going to wait until this passes by. And then you do that once and you think, God, I survived. That was okay. And then you do it again and the ferocity eases off. And then you do it again and you think, oh, that's not so bad. And then eventually you get to a point, you're holding on, you're thinking, this feels all right. And the thoughts and the emotions start to move through much, much quicker. Whereas, of course, what we do is we do the opposite. You know, we hold on, we think, oh my God, I really don't like this. I need to get away from this as quickly as possible. So we try to get as far away as we can from the experience. And of course, what we know happens is it's going to come back. Of course, it's going to come back. And it's going to come back stronger because, you know, you've ran from it and you've strengthened it. So of course, it's going to come back with more ferocity and strength. So what you're learning to do is to get really comfortable with the discomfort. And there's the power.
I mean, that's ultimately massively powerful. But we do need coaching through that. And I think that's something that you do beautifully through your books and your talks. And obviously you have your TEDx talk and various other resources if you go to Owen's website, as well as this, as I say, fantastic book. Before we finish today, if someone's listening to this and they're gripped with anxiety about life post-pandemic, what would you say to them? Where can they start?
I think a really healthy starting point is the acknowledgement, okay, this is where I'm at the moment. And I can't say how important that is. It might sound really cliched, but start with, okay, where am I at? Because if you don't acknowledge and accept where you're at the moment, it's really, really difficult to move forward from that. So I think the acknowledgement, okay, this is what I'm struggling with at the moment. And secondly, the acceptance of that. Now, this is where it gets a bit tricky, because that sounds a bit counterintuitive. You're asking people to accept the difficulty, but the reality is you're working with what you're working with. So if you're having a tough time at the minute and your anxiety is higher than normal and you're not coping as well as you would normally do, that's absolutely okay. If you're telling yourself that it's not okay, or you're resisting it, or you're fighting it, what you're doing is you're creating more distress. So it's about learning to kind of work with the fact, okay, look, I'm not in a perfect place at the moment. I'm not where I want to be, but that's 100% okay. Now, it's incredible, actually, the moment you do that, almost instantaneously, you feel a sense of relief, because what you've done is you've eased the burden, because nobody else is judging you the way you're judging yourself. No one. No one else is telling you that it has to be better than it is the way you're doing. So I guess it's just that, it's incredible, really. You know, you and I, if we meet people in our lives who are struggling and they're going through a really, really tough time, we wouldn't meet them and say, get your act together. What's wrong with you? You know, come on, get yourself together. We wouldn't. We'd be easy with them and say, it's all right. I'll stay around with you. Let me know what you need. Just take your time. Gentle steps, one step at a time. And the person would immediately respond to that. So what I would say is, where do we get started? That's where we get started. The acknowledgement and the acceptance. And the third point I want to make is then about the internal tone. How are you talking to yourself? And I'd really encourage anyone listening today to really ask themselves that question. How am I talking to myself? And ask yourself the question, if you wouldn't speak to another human being the way you're speaking to yourself, then that's where you need to get started.
I'm nodding furiously because I agree so wholeheartedly with everything you've said. I know from talking to other people that that is the worst critic of all. And sometimes it might have other voices mixed in there, you know, other influences mixed in there, but we can be so tough on ourselves.
So to answer your question, I could have given you a whole list of exercise, eat well, listen to podcasts, read, you know, I could give you a whole list of tools. And they would be great and they're helpful and they're useful. So I'm not minimizing any of them. But if you don't get that early stuff right around the acknowledgement, the acceptance and the internal tone, you don't get that right, the rest of it's a waste of time. Because you can eat all the right foods and you can go to the gym and you can read the right books. But if you're going to continue the internal sabotaging, nothing changes. So it's got to start with the fact that where you're at the minute is absolutely fine. Doesn't matter how awful it feels, or it doesn't matter how terrible it all feels, it's okay, because this is where you're at the moment. No one's judging it. And I guess really the moment you give yourself to be where you are and give yourself to feel what you're feeling at the moment, and then make the decision, okay, I'm going to look after you. So it's literally that internal voice thinking, it's okay, I've got you, I'm going to look after you. When you begin to make those changes, particularly around anxiety and mood, I mean, it's a game changer.
But also brings us back to where we were at the beginning, which is it starts with you, which is why learning how to be your own therapist doesn't negate the need for professional help, but actually can add something to your life if you're able to take that kinder tone, if you're able to reflect, if you're able to journal and see how you're treating yourself.
Yeah,
actually, that can really help.
Well, it's a bit like what you said earlier there. You said something really powerful. You said, oh God, this has been really, really great. I'm going to write some of this down. But now, like, you know this work and you understand this work and you do interviews and podcasts. So you're familiar with this language in this world and the conversations. But you're a human being. And like myself, sometimes you forget. Mm. And I guess really what I'm saying in this book is most people know what they need to do. I really believe that fundamentally. Most people know exactly what they need to do, but it's easy to get overwhelmed. And it's easy to forget. So I guess really what I'm doing is I'm bringing a focus back to, okay, let's have a look at how you're managing this. Let's have a look at how you're dealing with your thoughts. Let's have a look at how you're dealing with the emotions. Let's have a look truthfully at your story and tell your story and map it together and understand who you are as a human being. Because, you know, look, the one thing that we're all stuck with for the rest of our lives is ourselves. You know, that's the one thing we can't really divorce ourselves or get away from ourselves. We're stuck with who we are as human beings for the rest of our life. So I just think it's a pretty good idea to really form a good relationship with yourself, really, because it's the one permanent you're going to have for the remainder of your life. So why wouldn't you get a really great relationship going with yourself?
I mean, if you take away one thing from this conversation today, it should be that. Owen, I have loved this conversation. I loved your book. It's been great chatting to you. Definite light bulb moment there about responsibility and OCD. And I have been working on it for a long time. So there are more of those light bulb moments in your book. Can you share again your book and also where people can find you online?
Yeah, so the book is called How to Be Your Own Therapist. Here it is. It's available from all the usual bookstores. It's available on Amazon. I'm on Instagram. Most of my stuff I do on Instagram at OneOKane10. You can find me there. I try and create a lot of regular content. If you'd like to listen to TED Talk, if you go to YouTube and Google OneOKane TEDx, you'll find the TED Talk. It's only 18 minutes and that I talk about my own experience of growing up. The TED Talk's called Bombs, Bullets, Bullying and a Piano. And I use a piano on stage and I talk about my four tips for living a better life and getting the best from life. And I use a piano to demonstrate that. So it was a really exciting talk to do, but I think there's a lot of content in there and people are responding really well to it. So if you want a kind of quick, sharp view, that might be a good one to go to. And I hope, look, for anyone that does pick up the book, I sincerely hope it brings some hope and help and gives you an anchor to navigate your way through these tough times, because I do believe there is stuff in there that's going to help a lot of people. And if it helps you, please pass it on or tell someone else about it, because that's all of our responsibility. We hand over what we know and we reach out and we help each other with.
Owen, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been lovely. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to I Am, I Have. And I really recommend that you check out Owen's incredible TEDx talk, Bombs, Bullets, Bullying and a Piano. If you're looking for information about counselling, you can head over to counselling-directory.org.uk or download the free Happiful app to search for the best route for you. If you need immediate support, you can contact the Samaritans 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on 116 123 or email joe@samaritans.org. Help is available. This podcast has been produced and hosted by me, Lucy Donahue for Happiful. I hope you'll listen again soon.